You're listening to the History Nerd Podcast. I am a high school history teacher who teaches her students to investigate the facts for themselves and decide what they think happened. That's what I want to do here. I'll present you with facts and occasionally my opinion, but I want you to decide for yourself what you think happened. Just as a note, I do my best to research each story in full, but I may miss things here or there. I strive to use the most trustworthy sources and information I can find and give you my best judgment where things aren't clear, but I'm not a professional historian. All right, let's get started. It's the song that gets stuck in your head if someone even mentions its name. It's the most irritating ride at Disneyland, but definitely the best one for kids or if you need a break in a cool, dark place with hundreds of tiny dolls smiling at you and singing. Not creepy at all. It's been called the happiest cruise to ever sail the seven seas. It's a Small World is an iconic attraction that has lasted through the ages, and it has the most interesting backstory. Before we get started on the actual story of how the song and ride came to life, I need to give you some background on what was going on in America at the time. In the 1960s, we were at the height of the Cold War. For those of you who don't remember, the Cold War is basically tension between the United States and Soviet Union over nuclear weapons. There was never any armed conflict, but the world was on the edge of their seats, knowing that at any minute, either country could make a move that could possibly destroy the world. That's not even an exaggeration. To put it into perspective, according to the website ourworldindata.org, in 1962, which is considered by many to be the height of the Cold War, the United States had 25,540 nuclear warheads, and the Soviet Union had about 3,346. Now, this might seem like a huge discrepancy, but it would only take roughly 100 nuclear warheads to destroy the entire world. This all started at the end of World War II. After the war, Germany had been divided between the Western countries, which include Great Britain, France, and the United States, and the Soviet Union. The Western countries all opted for a democratic government in Germany, but the Soviet Union, which had been communist-run since 1917, was more interested in molding Germany into a communist country, which, for the record, is different from what it was under Hitler. Hitler was a fascist, and the differences between the two aren't really something we're going to get into in this episode. The United States was strongly opposed to the spread of communism, mostly because it went against everything we believed and held dear as Americans, namely our democratic freedoms. Under President Harry S. Truman, the Truman Doctrine was passed, which pledged the United States would give aid to any and all nations under the threat of communist takeover. Furthermore, we adopted a policy of containment. So this basically means that the United States wants to contain communism where it already was and prevent the spread of this form of government to other countries. So this is essentially what gets us involved in the Korean and Vietnam Wars, which are both stories for other episodes. To top it all off, in October of 1962, the world held their breath for 13 days as the Soviet Union and United States faced off during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, I'll admit, I get way too excited about Cold War politics because to me, it's absolutely fascinating. And the fact that we didn't blow the world up is astounding to me, especially considering how close we came to doing just that during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So to refresh your memory, in October of 1962, a U-2 spy plane from the United States flying over Cuba took photographs of Soviet nuclear missiles set up and aimed at the United States. Remember, Cuba's only about 90 miles off the coast of Florida, so that is dangerously close. The information was immediately relayed to President John F. Kennedy, who ordered a naval blockade of Cuba, as well as announced to the American public what was going on. He did this because the nuclear codes had not been delivered to Cuba yet. They were en route to Cuba via boat, hence the naval blockade. The Soviet Union and Cuba protested that this was an act of war from the United States. Things were tense as the United States set its military to DEFCON 3 for the first and only time in our history. If Kennedy and Khrushchev couldn't work this out diplomatically, nuclear war was certain. And just as a reminder, Khrushchev is the premier of the Soviet Union. Luckily, in the nick of time, Robert Kennedy and the Soviet ambassador to the United States, Nikolai Dobrynin, secretly reached an agreement that the Soviets would remove their missiles from Cuba if the United States would remove their missiles from Turkey.
Hold on. You never mentioned anything about missiles in Turkey. That's definitely within, it's close to the Soviet Union. What happened there?
So the United States had done the exact same thing that the Soviet Union had done in Cuba, but in Turkey. We had missiles assembled, ready to launch if need be. The reason that Robert Kennedy and Dobrynin reached a deal in secret was because the American public was not aware of this fact, and the Kennedy administration wanted to keep it quiet, because they didn't want the American public blaming Kennedy for the Soviet missiles in Cuba. Kind of sketchy, but there you have it. That's the Cuban Missile Crisis in a nutshell. We might have to dive deeper into it in a future episode because it is absolutely fascinating. In the midst of all this chaos and fear caused by the Cold War, the planning for the 1964-65 World's Fair was beginning. The World's Fair is basically a large exhibition featuring international participants and exhibits and all kinds of things you can go see. It's kind of like the world saying, hey, let's all get together and share all these cool ideas. It's hosted by a different country and city every year. The Eiffel Tower in Paris was built when they hosted the World's Fair, and the Ferris wheel was introduced at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. According to Time.com, there hasn't been a World's Fair in North America since 1986. It does still happen today, but not many countries participate anymore, and the United States doesn't even try to get the World's Fair here, mostly because of the cost. And I read an interesting fact that the Olympics typically make money for the countries and cities that host the Olympics, but if you hosted the World's Fair, it was all on your dime. So it was really expensive to host the World's Fair.
So it was just kind of just hard for like the city to make money out of that. And like, so basically like where the Olympics, you would make a profit, where this, you would not.
Yeah. You'd probably come out
even or a little more. Yeah. On top.
If that even. Yeah. So in the 1960s though, the entire country was looking forward to the 64-65 World's Fair, which would be held in New York City. These things take a lot of planning, however, so planning started in 1960. Robert Moses was in charge of planning the entire thing, and he knew he had to make it good. I mean, with the United States and Soviet Union, you know, being in such a tense situation, this was a chance for the United States to really show, you know, what we're capable of. So who better to help out with making the World's Fair magical than Walt Disney himself? Walt was at the height of his game. In 1960, Disneyland had been open for about 5 years, and it was the tourist destination. Families traveled from all around the country to go to Disneyland. Nothing has really changed as far as that goes, in my opinion. So, Robert Moses visited Walt in person and asked him to help out designing a children's village for the fair. So this was a place that would appeal to the kids and keep them entertained. As it turns out, Walt was already working with some sponsors to do something along those lines. So it was really a match made in heaven. Walt had some new technology that he wanted to test out, and it would be a great chance to test it out at the World's Fair before moving it to Disneyland, if they moved it to Disneyland at all. If it wasn't a success at the World's Fair, it was definitely not going to be moved to Disneyland. Pepsi-Cola became the official sponsor of the UNICEF Children's Pavilion at the fair, and they went full steam ahead with the project. According to WaltDisney.org, when Walt met with his Imagineers about designing, quote, a little boat ride, end quote, apparently the Imagineers were super confused. The article on the website quotes Rolly Crump, who was a Disney Imagineer at the time, as saying, quote, "We thought a little boat ride? We were working on Lincoln and the Carousel of Progress, both of which were using the highest technology and animatronic figures. All of this, and Walt wants to do a little boat ride?" End quote. Walt wanted a simple way to showcase the cultures of the world in one setting while keeping with the theme of the fair, which was peace through understanding. Remember, this was the height of the Cold War, so it seems that the theme of the fair was apt for the time period. Combining this theme with UNICEF's work with children around the world would create exactly the kind of attraction Walt had in mind. And of course, what's a Disney attraction without a song? The Sherman Brothers are the famous song composers of Walt Disney. Richard and Robert worked on many Disney classics such as Mary Poppins, The Jungle Book, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and of course, the most played song of all time, according to Time.com, It's a Small World After All. Walt's original idea was for each of the animatronic children to sing their own national anthem. But as you can imagine, this didn't quite work out. According to Richard Sherman, it was a cacophony of noises because the songs did not blend together at all. Just like every great entrepreneur and thinker, this didn't put Walt off of his idea. He simply pivoted. He told the Sherman Brothers he wanted a new, one-of-a-kind song that could be translated into languages from all over the world. Walt's words to them were, quote, "It is a small world after all," end quote. That simple sentence alone was all the brothers needed to get rolling. They composed the song originally as a ballad, but Walt didn't think that would appeal to children as much, so they reconfigured it into the upbeat, get-stuck-in-your-head tune we all know and love today. This Prayer for Peace plays at all 5 Disney parks around the world, which means that this song is being played at all times somewhere in the world. Richard Sherman even said, quote, "When you play it up tempo like that and you hear it for 10 minutes, you can't get it out of your head. I know," end quote.
I mean, it's stuck in my head right now, but I mean, it's the 60s. And I mean, obviously it's not the technology. It's not the ride that we see today. So, and like the whole idea at the time had to be super expensive. What was the budget for this little village?
Yeah. So, he had a couple of different designers and a couple of different artists. But I think Alice Davis's experience best sums up how Walt felt about the pricing of all of this. Alice Davis was the designer for the dolls, like their costumes and stuff. And so when she asked Walt how much money she could spend, he looked at her, raised his eyebrow, and said, quote, We don't think like that here. I want you to do whatever it takes to make these look like dolls every woman in the world would want to have." End quote. The Sherman brothers apparently believed it would be shut down after the fair. ABC News quotes them as saying later that they never thought in their wildest dreams that it would go where it did, being such a huge attraction at Disneyland. But it was a huge hit at the fair. Travelguide.com says It's a Small World sold about 10 million tickets at the fair. So because of that success, Walt had it packed up and shipped to Disneyland, where it remains today. As mentioned above, it has been replicated in each Disney park. The original at Disneyland obviously has undergone a few renovations, but according to some of the sources, you can actually still see some of the shipping labels on some of the bigger set pieces. It didn't specify where and when in the ride to look for them, but it did say they're there. Walt himself loved the efficiency of moving a lot of people through the ride continuously. So the same technology that they used for It's a Small World was used when designing Pirates of the Caribbean just a couple years later. The song was composed only a short time after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And as writer Sophie Jo on WaltDisney.org says so eloquently, quote, "The lyrics describe a world of hope and a world of fears, before urging listeners to remember that there's so much that we share," end quote. And I think that's a good thing. I think that maybe the world could use this reminder today that it really is a small world. We do share it. And so it's time that we're aware of the fact. And maybe Walt Disney's message for the Cold War still rings true to us today. Thanks for listening to today's episode of the History Nerd Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to our show on whatever platform you listen to podcasts on, and please consider leaving us a 5-star review. It really does help a lot.